I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. The oldest known recording of the country's oldest orchestra, the New York Philharmonic. I'm no outside observer when it comes to the Phil. I'm on the board. I think it's central to the life of this city, and I believe that today's guest has positioned it better than ever for the challenging years ahead. When Alan Gilbert took over as conductor and music director in 2009, he knew the line he had to walk. Be new enough to stay vital, traditional enough to stay solvent. A familiar Stravinsky tour de force, for example, tends to sell many more tickets than a piece by a living composer. Frequent concert goers, after all, average 60 years old. Almost one-third say they'd go less often if programs included more contemporary music. If anyone could thread that needle, it was Gilbert. The son of two former New York Phil violinists, he'd literally grown up with the institution. But his heart beats to newer, edgier music. That's Le Grand Macabre, Gilbert's first big project with the Phil. It was a hit, sold out the entire run. Huge reviews. He showed it was possible. The Philharmonic can evolve and triumph, but some of his later modern programs met with smaller crowds and internal opposition. Last year, Gilbert announced he was phasing himself out of the job. Directing an ensemble as technically perfect as the Phil poses at least one unexpected challenge.
In a way, I would almost say that it's to keep them from being too professional, to remember how it feels to share the experience of playing music together as if it were the first time. I remember the first time I played in an orchestra. It must have been dreadful. It was the Juilliard Pre-College Orchestra, and I was the last chair second violinist. I just squeaked into the best orchestra in pre-college, and we were reading Brahms' Third Symphony for the first time, and it's one of the hardest pieces to play, and it had to have sounded, you know, wretched, mm-hmm. this first reading. But I was so thrilled. It was so exciting to hear the entire group playing the same piece. And I thought it was probably the greatest thing that had ever happened, as, you know, in the history of orchestras. And that sense of enthusiasm and discovery and freshness is difficult to preserve. The schedule that the New York Philharmonic maintains is just ridiculous.
Do you recommend they do less?
Absolutely. Less music, more time off. It's kind of like being on a hamster wheel that just keeps going on and on. And I've said this many times, and I really believe it. New York is the toughest music market in the world and has a constant parade of the greatest orchestras coming through and the next to greatest orchestras coming through, all bringing their A game. People don't play in New York on tour unless they've prepared as well as they possibly can. They play in their programs. They try them in different venues. Finally, they're ready for the big time in New York. They play in New York, and they try to knock it out of the park. The New York Philharmonic plays every week in New York.
Right.
Normal four rehearsal schedule, new program. Next week, four rehearsals, new program. I guarantee you, if we gave the New York Philharmonic schedule book to any other orchestra in the world and say, okay, you play this, people's perceptions of the relative merits of orchestras would shift. I mean, if you can achieve something incredibly artistic after a lot of hard work, great, more power to you. But the fact is that the New York Philharmonic is playing under a much more challenging circumstance.
Well, why is the Philharmonic so extensive? Why?
Well, there are a lot of challenges that are just inherent in the situation that surrounds the New York Philharmonic. Their demands to generate revenue, to always have ticket sales, and their fixed costs that are being paid all the time, whether or not the orchestra plays.
For this space.
for the space and for the musicians themselves. And it's, I guess, efficiency. You know, I'm not in the business office, thankfully for, everyone involved. But the fact is that people look at the schedule and say, oh, look at this law. We could do another concert here. So, let's see, maybe this is the place we could do a benefit concert. Or maybe if we have one rehearsal and one concert, what could we do with one rehearsal and one concert? And the idea is to, to use the orchestra to the extent possible allowed by the contract. And when that kind of thinking starts to forget take over, but even creep in, the artistic health of the orchestra and the sort of, call it, aesthetic integrity of the musicians is not the first, these are not the first things that are being considered. The number of notes that they played, we did Das Rheingold complete. I mean, that's just like ridiculous. It's 2.5 hours of incredibly hard music. And then we did Mahler's Seventh Symphony, which is like unbelievably difficult. And then we just jumped immediately into the Parks program, which is also hard. Dvorak New World and Symphonic Dances from West Side Story. Sounds easy when the orchestra plays it. It's one of the hardest pieces to play, Gershwin and American in Paris. And we also had a concert up at St. John the Divine for Memorial Day, Mahler Fourth Symphony thrown in. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's
a lot of work.
Yeah, it's hard.
Now, obviously, everybody knows your story, first native New Yorker to lead the orchestra, and your family and your mom and dad being in the orchestra, you being the little kid with the handing everybody's passports. Go ahead, if you want to say
something. No. I have just fond memories when I think back. I knew everybody in the orchestra. I knew everybody's name, and I remember sitting on the plane. Do you remember Mattel Electronics Football? That was like the first video game, and it was like these little red blips that didn't even move, but the next one would light up as the ball went and stuff. It was certainly by today's standards unbelievably rudimentary, but I loved that game. And so did Roland Koloff. He was the principal timpanist. So we would play this game together, and then later on it became the Rubik's Cube, and I would hang out with the orchestra, and it's amazing to think that it's come to this.
You started playing an instrument when you were how old?
I always had a violin from the time I was really,
and your
really
own
little.
And your request or other people promoted?
Well, we have a kind of violin-happy family. My parents are both violinists, and my father's father was a violinist, and his brother is a horn player, but he also studied the violin, and his sister is a pianist, but she also studied the violin, and my sister is a violinist. Let's not even get into it. It is what it is. But
and you wanted it.
I did not want it.
Right.
I mean, kids don't just take up an instrument for the most part when they're really little, unless their parents try to set up something. But I think it cuts both ways. It's certainly helpful, and I think it served me very well to have come from a musical family and to have been around the world that I actually inhabit full time now, but that was what I knew growing up. But if you are self-motivated and have to do it on your own, that also can lead to a certain kind of strength.
When did you understand that you were good, that you could really, really play? How old were you when someone said to you, you're really good?
I went to Juilliard pre-college. Certainly there were more dazzling violinists around, so I never thought I was one of the best, but I could play. And I knew that if I wanted to, I could become a professional violinist. That was something that I knew I was good enough to earn a living. And the one difference I've noticed more than anything between people who come from musical families and people who come from families in which nobody's a musician is many of those people are told by their parents, oh, it's a risky profession. You should go into something that's more secure, where income is more guaranteed. They imagine the life of a bohemian musician who's, scraping to get by just from day to day. I never once doubted that I could make a living, at least to get by as a musician, because I saw what my parents did, and it just didn't occur to me that music wasn't a viable profession, if you see what I mean.
You went to Fieldston.
Well, I went to Fieldston, but Juilliard Pre-College was a Saturday weekend program.
Yeah. So when you leave Fieldston, where do you go?
I went to Harvard.
For music?
Not really.
I was going to find out for what.
I just went for Harvard. I wanted to go, and I thought it would be an exciting place to be, and it was, because there are a lot of very passionate people who were you know, whatever they're doing it because they're really interested in it. And you, the conversations you would hear at the in the dining room were about anything, you know, ranging
from— What did you study?
Well, I finally graduated as a music concentrator, but that was more convenience than the fact that it was really what I wanted to study at Harvard. I did get a good education in music theory and composition and history and things like that. It's almost not at all performance at Harvard. You know, people would joke with certain degree of accuracy that at Harvard music was meant to be seen and not heard. But I was also studying violin, and we organized many concerts. But I really was interested in was English and poetry. And I took as many courses in those subjects as I could. Finally, since I was, just because of the distribution and because I was pretty lazy student, actually, it just made more sense to graduate as a music concentrator.
And after that, you went to Curtis.
Exactly.
Right. And all this time, you're still performing. You're still playing the violin. And you have a sense at some point that you said that you, although you knew you could make a living at it and get a seat at some ensemble around the world, that you knew you weren't the greatest. When does conducting enter the conversation?
My dad is a good conductor, and you shouldn't get the idea that he was this kind of fierce, you know, tiger dad, you know, compelling me to pursue conducting, because it wasn't like that at all. But he did show me certain basics of conducting technique, the patterns of moving your arms for beating four and in three, and how to start Beethoven Fifth Symphony, which is a challenging start because it starts with a rest. There's the first impulse is a silence, you know, but there's an impulse. That's a tricky thing to conduct, actually, even though it's, you know, the iconic moment in music. So I had some sense of what conducting was about. And when I was in pre-college, because I was the concertmaster in my senior year, there were rehearsals that the conductor asked me to take over. So I did string sectionals conducting the orchestra. It was kind of lucky the way I first actually stood in, the time I first stood in front of an orchestra, there was a guest conductor for one of the programs that the pre-college orchestra did. And it was conducted by a guy by the name of Ronald Bronstein. And because of scheduling issues or for whatever reason, the next rehearsal after his concert, in other words, the first rehearsal of the next cycle for the next program, was going to be conducted by our regular conductor, Roger Nierenberg. But he couldn't get back for that one rehearsal. So Ronald, instead of starting to rehearse Roger's program, decided to give some of the students in the orchestra the chance to conduct. And it happened that my sister was walking down Broadway and ran into him, and he told her what he was planning to do. She was also in the orchestra. And she said, oh, I bet my brother would be interested in that.
So this is your Bernstein Carnegie Hall moment.
Well, in a way, on an incredibly small scale. And, you know, I gave him a call and he said, yeah, okay, you're lucky. There's one more slot. You can prepare the first movement of Dvorak's Sixth Symphony. And I worked with my dad for 2 or 3 days. And I had my moment in front of the orchestra, and it was completely new and completely terrifying. And after that, you know, sometimes these first moments with a new experience are so crucial, and they really determine the direction that you end up going. It could either go, you know, one direction, or if the experience is negative or difficult or scary in the wrong way, you end up completely giving up. But he said something to me after, and I don't know, I'm sure it was hyperbole or just kind of, he was throwing words around. But he said, you know, if I had my way, I'd kick out the entire class at Juilliard and I'd put you in the conducting class there. He said, you have talent. And I was like, wow. So when I went to Harvard then, I had this experience of conducting, and almost right away when I got there, I auditioned to be assistant conductor of the Harvard Radcliffe Orchestra, which I got. I think I was lucky. It was unusual for a freshman to get a position like that. But because of that, I actually got to conduct the orchestra and performance and do rehearsals and things. And using the videotape from one of those performances, I applied to Tanglewood for the summer conducting program at Tanglewood with Seiji Ozawa and Gustav Meyer. And I got in, and so I was able to start studying there. The big crossroads for me came when I was getting ready to graduate from college, and I was planning to go to a conservatory, and I had to really decide, will I go as a violinist or as a conductor? And I decided to apply as a conductor because I figured sort of what I already had thought, I'm a decent violinist. I could make a living as a violinist, even if I don't go study at a conservatory now. Let's just see how the conducting thing goes. So I ended up getting into Curtis, and I went to Curtis for 3 years, and then I continued with the same teacher, Otto Werner-Müller, at Juilliard. I got my master's degree.
So Curtis and then Juilliard after that.
Yeah. I can't complain about my education.
Yeah, any failings that I have. Leave no academic stone unturned here.
Yeah, no, I was
conducting during those two periods as well?
Yeah, Curtis and Juilliard. Although I did study violin, it was wonderful. I got to
work. You steer sharply in the direction of conducting at both Curtis and Juilliard.
I was a conducting student, but while I was at Curtis, I studied violin with Yasha Brodsky, one of the great violin teachers who was there at the time, and I also auditioned to be on the Philadelphia Orchestra substitute musician list. And just because of the way things were those years, there were a lot of openings. I think a couple of people were on sick leave. There were people out on maternity leave or whatever. And I played basically full-time in the Philadelphia Orchestra while I was studying at Curtis as a violinist.
You know, for me, as a non-pro, if you will, but a devoted fan of that music, someone will play the fourth movement of the Mahler Ninth almost 3 minutes longer than someone. I mean, some people just squeeze the hell out of the adagios and so forth. In my mind, what a conductor does, not only base it on that information and those numbers on those downloads, that you decide the pace that it's played. Is that correct? You play it your way.
I think that tempo is the single most important attribute or characteristic of an interpretation. Early on, there was no separate profession of conductor.
Right.
Very often, the composer would lead the performance, or maybe the first violinist, the concertmaster, would guide things along. But essentially, if a pulse was kept, people could play along. Jean-Baptiste Lully, the French composer, actually famously killed himself, supposedly, so the story goes, because what they did is not wave a stick in the air, but actually he beat his staff on the floor. And apparently he missed and impaled his foot with the staff, and he contracted gangrene. Yeah, and he ended up dying. Yeah. So it's a hazardous profession even today, but back then I guess it could have been worse. But as music got more complicated, it became more useful and maybe even necessary for there to be an outside person who was not playing an instrument.
Who could listen
and guide everybody. And the idea of a modern conductor with that kind of mythical status, this kind of mystical presence who would shape the music and come up with an interpretation, when it was the composer himself, the idea was to present the piece. But then when Mendelssohn started performing the music of Bach and when Liszt started doing other composers' music, the idea was to come up with a personal take, and it became a thing. And now, obviously, with very complicated music, tricky meters and stuff, the idea of just giving people an indication of where's the tempo
in Rite of Spring.
Yeah, for example. I mean, that would be really, really hard for an orchestra to do, if not impossible,
alone,
without a conductor. And it becomes an aesthetic, even philosophical question, what an interpretation is. I try to find the right tempo at every moment. Right tempo. What is the right tempo? You're pointing out that there are many different ways you can do it, but something... It's different for different people. It's different for different situations.
But you have a sense there's a better way to play it.
Well, you have to find the tempo that's absolutely right for you, that is completely organic for your relationship with the piece. And that's what I do when I study. I'm trying to digest the music to the point where if I open the score randomly to any page, I get an immediate and visceral kind of reaction to the notes I see on the page, and I have the sense that this is how they have to go.
And then you have to sell it to them?
And then, well, what happens is, it's interesting, when you know a piece that well, as you're conducting it, you don't have to consciously do anything. It comes out that way. The gesture takes care of itself. Yeah, and that's what you rehearse for.
Or in rehearsal, do they ever say to you, I would like to play it another way? They don't do that.
Sure, they do that, sure. Absolutely, especially if there's a solo. And that's what makes it fun, because the chemistry and the kind of give and take of, it's like a vessel with two chambers, and the kind of the fluid can kind of shift back and forth. And the idea is sometimes you give over a little bit of the lead to the soloist who's playing a solo, and you react to it. But it's all together, and that soloist will feel differently about the solo, even if they have their own interpretation, if you will, based on your presence and your physicality. And so if you see, a great jazz combo playing, like we just had Winton the other day, and it was so interesting to watch them play together, because you can tell that even though they're improvising, they're completely affecting each other. And when one person does something, they react to it and they emphasize a certain impulse or, click in the beat, and then that in turn inspires the one who made the first move, and it's this kind of constant feedback loop. That also happens with music that's written down. I've done the same piece with two different orchestras in consecutive weeks, and although my interpretation hasn't dramatically changed, the way the piece ends up coming out is very different.
Is everybody doing the exact same thing, but in their own way? Some of them seem to be ahead of the beat, and some of them seem to be on the beat.
Yeah, that's a very interesting observation, because it's absolutely true. With some conductors, orchestras will tend to make a sound that's closer to where it seems as if it's called the ictus of their beat, the sort of the click where the beat actually happens. There's either greater or lesser delay from that. And it depends on the quality of the gesture. And it's very hard to describe why that works and how that works. It's also according to the orchestra. Certain orchestras play closer to the beat than others. Like the Cleveland Orchestra, for example, tends to play closer to the visual, where the beat looks as if it is, than the New York Philharmonic. A lot of European orchestras, German orchestras play even more behind the beat. And this is where it gets interesting, because it's about tempo, it's about rhythm. It's also about sound quality. If you imagine a sound that goes gack, that's like right there. There's no delay.
Beat for that.
Yeah. Or if it's that, that there's a kind of delay.
You roll it.
And it can't possibly start at such a determinate time. I remember when I first played in the Philadelphia Orchestra, I was early. I came in, I made a sound before the other musicians, because there is more delay there. So I would see Ricardo Muti give a gesture and he would go boom, and I would go boom right there, and everyone else would wait. And the sound would come out later. And after a while, I didn't have to make that calculation, that adjustment. And it's different from the New York Philharmonic.
That's an institutional.
Yeah, it's not a conscious thing. It's not like they talk about it, but it's the culture of sound. It's the tradition of the way they collectively create rhythm and sound. I remember seeing Herbert von Karajan conduct the Vienna Philharmonic, and it was I've never seen anything like this. How far ahead of the sound his beat was. It looked like he was almost in the next measure. They were playing Schubert Unfinished Symphony. He was beating along, and I swear I couldn't see any connection between what he was doing.
They were two different time zones.
Yeah, he was like, he was already on the plane and they were still getting to the airport or something. It was so bizarre, but they played so beautifully. So an orchestra that has a kind of more precise way of making sound will tend not to play so far behind the beat. Generally speaking, orchestras in France, which are very precise in the way they approach rhythm and maybe not quite as voluptuous in the sound quality that they make as, say, for example, a German orchestra, they tend to play closer to the beat. And then when I first conducted the Philadelphia Orchestra, the first beats I conducted with the Philadelphia Orchestra, the sound came so much later than I expected. I almost fell off the stage because it was such a shock. I gave a beat and they didn't play. And then what seemed like an eternity later, the sound came back to me perfectly together. It was really bizarre.
When you do this kind of work, you have to have this keen, almost mathematical aptitude to fit all these Scrabble tiles in your skull every day of all these notes. And when you talk about entrances, I think to myself, what if there's more than one entrance? Or what if the entrances all fall on top of each other? Who gets picked?
They make their entrances whether you give them a dedicated cue or not, because, they know where they are and they're counting.
So when you beat an entrance for multiple, they know it's for all of them.
It's not to make sure that they play.
Right.
It's to help them enter in the way that you want them to, right, and with the spirit and with the character that you want.
Right.
They don't. You don't need to look at them to play, and there's no way. You don't always even certain entrances from one concert to the next. You'll give them a look or not. It's very comforting if a player is counting a lot of rests to get your eye a couple of measures before, and then confirmation that it's time for them to play at the correct moment.
Outgoing New York Philharmonic conductor Alan Gilbert. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. One of the living composers whose work Gilbert brought to New York audiences is Esa-Pekka Salonen. The concert this spring, where Gilbert conducted Salonen's L.A. Variations, is just one example of his difficult balancing act. Salonen is a great conductor in his own right, too, currently at the Philharmonia Orchestra in London. But on Here's the Thing, he told me he is frustrated that there's so much more attention paid to conductors than to composers.
I had a really kind of illuminating experience in L.A. some years ago. I was at Starbucks, actually, queuing for my coffee. And there was a guy in front of me who asked whether I was so-and-so, and I said, yes, I am. And he said that he was also a composer. And he told me that he had written a couple of songs for Madonna and, you know, these huge names. And his name doesn't appear anywhere. And I thought, so it's not only a classical music problem.
Hear more stories from my talk with Esa-Pekka Salonen at heresthething.org. A few years ago, I collaborated with Alan Gilbert on a program where the Philharmonic performed famous film scores live to picture. It was exhilarating for me, but I worried it would feel like just another concert for Gilbert. I needn't have.
I had never done that, and that was so great.
We were terrified to pitch that to you, by the way. We
I thought don't know why, because no, I
totally, sure you'd like.
Well,
to do
I,
that.
I'm happy with the ones I chose to do. I mean, certainly the 2001 and the right. Manhattan. I mean, they're such great films, first of all, right. And the way music is used is so integral to the whole artistic product.
Right. 2001 was great.
It was, I mean, and it was one of the hardest things that I've ever done, because essentially, you have to coordinate, because Kubrick was such a genius. I mean, it was no accident when certain moments in the film visually happened in relation to the music. You know, when the spaceship shows up, you know, boom, something has to happen there. And you, if you're not, right. You know, if you don't hit that mark exactly right, you know, you're taking away from the impact and the value of the film. So I really worked very hard. And whoever had prepared the score, maybe it worked for them, but there were time marks all through the score. But they weren't right, actually. So I literally spent hours going through and figuring out how to mark my score. And I tried to the best of my ability. I mean, I'm no professional in the world of cinema, but I tried to really identify which moments were crucial and which moments there was some play. Because, you know, if you have one moment where, say, a horn starts to play, and that's where, you know, the sun shows up or whatever, and in the movie, okay, you know you have to hit that, but then there may be, you know, 20 seconds in which it's not so crucial, and that made it possible to figure out how to pace those, say, 20 seconds in order to end up at the right place. Without it feeling too metronomic. It's difficult. You want it to sound natural, and you want it to sound as if it's your own interpretation, but it also has to fit with the film. And what I had to practice during the rehearsals was how to either make up time or give time back. Because, you know, sometimes you're ahead. You know, there are time marks, and you say, okay, I'm a little bit ahead. And the ones where it doesn't matter, then you know you have to slow it down. You can't just suddenly slow it down, because then it'll sound like a discontinuity in the music. You have to know, okay, if I slow down this much, then by the time, you know, five measures later, then we'll be able to hit the next mark. And that sort of interaction is completely different from what we do usually. Because, you know, if something slows down a little bit in the concert, that's okay. That's what happens. And you don't have to try to make it up. You know, you're not trying to end the piece in the exact same amount of time that you did it the night before. If it's a little slower the next night, right. No big deal. Yeah. But that doesn't work with the movie. You can't end 2 minutes later than the movie.
Right.
I hit four of the big five orchestras in my development. I was really, really lucky to see how these all wonderful orchestras worked so differently from each other.
And then your first major appointment is in Sweden.
Was in Sweden. I started working as a guest conductor, Royal Stockholm Philharmonic was looking for a chief conductor, and I didn't even know it at the time. And I conducted the orchestra, and they invited me back for essentially a tryout week because I hadn't worked with. There were a lot of regular musicians who didn't play my concert. It was a summer concert, so people were on leave, and so they brought me back as soon as possible, which was early in the next season. And I did a huge program. We did a Don Juan of Strauss and Mozart Oboe Concerto and the Rite of Spring, in fact. And I guess that went well enough that they asked me to be their chief conductor. So I took on a position there, and I was there for 8 years. And then landed in New York.
Who contacts who and says to you, we'd like to talk to you?
There were conversations kind of before I was invited to be music director about a completely different setup that was being imagined involving another conductor who would have been the music director and what I would have been is some kind of principal conductor or some other lesser title. But the idea was that there would be two of us. And I would have conducted a lot of.
Was that another conductor that they talked about? Somebody you liked and admired, and you wouldn't
absolutely
mind
no. We and it was a very exciting opportunity for me because I wasn't angling to become music director of the New York Philharmonic.
And then what happened?
Well, that fell apart
because they couldn't afford that person.
No, just let's leave it at it fell apart. And so then you know I guess they went back to the drawing board, and sometime later they They called Zarin Mehta called me up. And
who made that? Was it Zarin who drove that? Who drove that?
You know, I don't know the internal workings.
You don't? No one bothered to tell you?
Well, I mean—
Did you want to know?
Essentially, the way it works is that a lot of people get together, and there's a search committee that's made up of musicians and board members and administrators and sometimes some outside people. I don't actually know exactly who was on the search committee that ended up choosing me, but obviously there was a critical mass of consensus.
But Zarin was your champion.
Apparently, which I will always appreciate. And I'll never forget the phone call. And this is an absolutely true story. I was traveling in Japan with my family, and I had, at the time, two young children. It was 8 years ago, so Estra was three, I think, or it was 9 years ago. So he was even two, and Noemi was three or something like that. And they had finally fallen asleep. We had had a torturous night. You know how it is with jet lag,
sure.
Just, you know, for us, but for little kids, it's impossible. And they'd finally fallen asleep, and I got a call from Zarin Mehta just after they had fallen asleep. And he said, well, Alan, I'd you know, like to invite you to be our next music director. And I said, that's great, Zarin, but my kids just fell asleep. I can't talk to you now. He thought I was out of my mind. But my wife and I were so happy that they had fallen asleep. And so I just, you know, I hung up and I said, guess what? They just asked me to be music director. And you know, we were like trying to contain ourselves. But then I called him back and we had a
I want to put that scene in a movie where a guy's like, more than being the music director of the Philharmonic, I want my kids to go to sleep.
Yeah,
click.
Totally.
We all know the madness of that moment. So how did you feel?
You know, I had a sense that it was in the air, but I absolutely didn't expect it. And you can hope for something like that, but you know, it's ridiculous to expect it. I was thrilled because obviously it's a great orchestra and it's my hometown orchestra.
Sure.
And to be able to work with them on a regular basis.
It was your home as well, because both your parents are here. So when you arrive and you begin, whether you had any preconceptions or not, what reality sinks in once you have the job? You get the job and you come in, then what?
I have to say I was pretty prepared because of my very close connection and knowledge of the orchestra over the years. And I pretty well, I mean, I'm not just patting myself on the back about this, but I called it pretty well what the trajectory of my time at the Philharmonic would be. I predicted to Kajsa 8 years when we started, and it's turned out to be exactly 8 years. And I knew that there would be ups and downs and some more challenging periods. What was nice and surprising in a good way was that some of the kind of call it out-of-the-box initiatives that I started, were really accepted by the orchestra and by the community around the orchestra. Things like the Contact series and the production of Grand Macabre that we did in my first season. I mean, that was completely new. It was like nothing the orchestra had done or tried before. And that was really important for me to have a success with those things early on, because that bought me time, that gave me cred, and it made it possible to continue to try to do other things.
Now, for people who don't understand this completely, what the orchestra plays, there's a committee that decides that, or you decide, or both?
At the end of the day, you could sort of simplify the equation and say that I decide.
You decide.
Theoretically, as music director, I have the power to decide everything. I don't think that would be a good way to go about it for a lot of reasons. It's too difficult. It would take too much time. It's too complicated because so many pieces have to fall into place. If you have guest artists involved, and you almost always do, they have to be engaged. The contract has to be written. The schedule has to be organized.
Factor in what they want to play.
Absolutely. Right. Guest conductors. You know,
so when Yo-Yo or somebody like that comes here, you don't say to them, you're going to play this. They tell you what they'd like to play.
Well, it's not that simple. Both. I mean, it's a conversation with someone like Yo-Yo, who's a good friend of mine. We'll talk about it. And I'll say, hey, would you think about, you know, playing this piece? And he'll say either yes, for sure, I'd love to do that, or I'm not so interested in doing that. You know, would you consider this? Or it's a give and take. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, you want people to be happy about what they're doing here. Different music directors function in different ways, though. I've guest conducted at certain orchestras where the music director will say, hey, do whatever you want. And so I'll suggest a program. And if it works with their season, and if it's a piece that they haven't played too recently, they'll accept it. Other music directors will say, no guest conductor can do Brahms. I'm the only conductor who will do Brahms with the orchestra, for example. Or all the Mahler symphonies are just saved for me.
Right.
And that's not... It's not unusual.
Have you felt that way?
I've never operated that way.
Never.
I think it's good for the orchestra to experience music, similar music with different points of view.
But just as I don't favor all classical repertoire equally, I'm assuming you don't either. And is there a point when you're scripting and you're writing the program for the year that you sit there and say, I don't really feel that great about this, but it's something we should play?
Absolutely. You're in the fortunate position as music director that you don't have to do anything you don't want to do. But the way I've tried to program is to combine things in meaningful ways, to create fresh contexts for pieces to shine with the greatest possible resonance. And I happen to believe that showing connections, for example, between Beethoven and music that was, written centuries later can be illuminating.
Another thing that I noticed, as a concert goer, is that there's times that the maestro, yourself included, obviously, is on the podium with no sheet music. And do you conduct with no score because you just know it so well? Is that what the difference?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of music that I can do without the score, and I would have to say I prefer to do music without the score, but I don't feel compelled to do music without the score. There are some conductors who, maybe just because they can, or maybe because they think it's important, insist on doing everything without the score. It shouldn't matter. Just because you have the score there doesn't mean that you don't have to know it as well. But you have to know it in a different way if you're going to conduct without the score. So you have to make sure you're not going to make mistakes and you really remember what's going on. I'm lucky I'm able to learn pieces easily and conduct without the score, but I do so much music, sometimes it's just more comfortable to have the music there.
No, I'll be there and I'll watch this music performed by whoever is conducting, whoever the ensemble is. And I mean, it's just sometimes it crushes me, it just overwhelms me. Does that happen to you? Do you ever perform music and not that you have that kind of plainly visible reaction, but just sometimes does it just overwhelm you?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, there are times when I really, I'm in the middle of conducting Dvorak New World Symphony, which we've all done how many gazillions of times. And it's just such a fantastic piece. It's just so exciting and so natural and heartfelt and beautiful and so well written for the orchestra. I was thinking, damn, this is unbelievable that we get to do this.
Thank you.
and then we did the Symphonic Dances from West Side Story by Bernstein. One of the greatest compositions of the 20th century. Yeah. You know, and then in American Paris, as I said, these are three pieces that were
three good ones.
premiered by the New York Philharmonic.
Wow, I didn't know that.
How cool is that? I mean, what orchestra can say that? I mean, just, you know, three iconic works all brought to life by the New York Philharmonic. And here I am conducting the New York Philharmonic in those very three pieces.
Now, music directors, most nights of the year, you're out working.
It's very difficult. And this last stretch leading up to, you know, these last concerts that I'm doing in New York City have been crazy. There have been tributes, and I've been out just about every single night. And, you know, my kids understand what's going on, but, you know, they say very recently, they say, you know, when are you not going to be going out? You know, are you going out again? And it's not only the nights, it's just everything else. There's so many things that go along with the responsibilities of being a music director, meetings, planning things, and just like unlikely stuff, you know, writing a letter to this person or thanking this donor. I mean, all really worthwhile things that obviously have to be done. But with American orchestras, the music director, frankly, has so much power that there are certain things that won't happen unless I weigh in on them. So it really gums up the works if I don't act on things. So there's a kind of constant drip of just little things that have to be taken care of. And I'm really not going to miss that. I'll be around. I'm conducting the Juilliard Orchestra in a concert in sometime maybe January. And I'll be here just about every month teaching at Juilliard for a few days at a time. And, I mean, I'm a New Yorker at heart. And
sure.
So, you know, I actually am not, you know, 100% happy about the move, nor is Kajsa. Kajsa has become more a New Yorker than I think I am, actually. She's really taken to the city and loves it. And I think she'll miss it maybe even more than she realizes.
People have written some very, very kind things about you and your evolution in this job.
Those are the good critics you're talking about.
Yeah, they're the smart ones. The brilliant critics, yeah. The only ones worth dealing with. And all of them use the same kind of hot buttons, grand macabre, and things you tried that they thought were very admiring of and your devotion to new music. And they said some very, very kind things about you. And when you leave here, what's your feeling? Like if you had just in a paragraph, you look back on it, and it was what to you?
I think the orchestra is playing better than ever.
Right.
I think they sound incredible.
I agree.
I think I can take some credit for that.
I agree.
And there's a kind of attitude about the shared experience that the musicians have of really cooperating and supporting each other and helping each other to sound as good as possible, a spirit of collegiality and mutual support that is fresh. I don't think it was as strong before. And the willingness of the musicians to take risks and go outside of the usual box of what is asked of musicians has been incredible and really gratifying. I mean, the things that we've been doing that they do without batting an eye now would have been unthinkable.
And not that what was before was bad or not, you know, or anemic in any way. You left the institution in better shape artistically than when you found it.
Means a lot to hear you say that, Alec. I think what all arts organizations, orchestras for sure, but not just orchestras, need to do is to really think hard about what their purpose is and what we're trying to accomplish and what we stand for. And if you really believe strongly enough, then you should find the courage to make it happen and take whatever risks are necessary, because it is about art and it is about the human condition. And these are very lofty things to say, but ultimately that's why we do it.
Alan Gilbert, the New York Philharmonic's groundbreaking former music director. I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing.